Thank you. Well, I'm certainly hoping it goes rather better than the last time the Scots visited Worcester, but we'll see. The Margaret Hodge story reminded me irresistibly of the much-loved and much-lamented Library and Information Commission, which, before it closed, planned to run an advertising campaign in favour of books and against the cinema. And it began with a poster of two people sitting on the top of a bus looking down at a cinema which was showing Jane Eyre, and one person saying to the other, "Oh, should we go and see that?" And the other one saying, "No, I've read the book." I always thought it was rather nice. Anyway, what I want to talk about is the future of libraries, and by implication, the future of librarianship, and what to me seems the lack of any underpinning philosophy at the moment of what we should be doing and why, and to talk a little about my view of what that might be. This is one of my favourite cartoons from The Far Side, which sums up what a lot of librarians tend to be going through at the moment. "The picture's pretty bleak, gentlemen. The world's climates are changing, the mammals are taking over, and we all have a brain about the size of a walnut." It is inevitably a male dinosaur standing at the podium there. The two quotes come from, the first one comes from the first professional book I ever bought by the then librarian of Reading, Jimmy Thompson. "The librarians and libraries that don't accept the change will inevitably be victims of the evolution. For the dinosaurs, it will indeed be the end." And the even more revered and even further back Fred Lancaster, "We're already very close to the day in which a great science library could exist in a space less than 10 feet square." Well, Fred Lancaster was wrong. An entire library can exist in a space 10 feet square, not just a science library. And Jimmy was sort of wrong, because he wrote that 30 years ago, and we still have libraries. Nonetheless, I think the underlying sentiment is generally sound. And partly that's because of the way the world has moved around. I go into bookshops and buy books a lot, as many of you, I guess, did. I rarely complain in bookshops, because they usually have what I want, or they can get it very quickly. But last Christmas, I did complain. I went into my local Borders in Glasgow, where they were selling a product which I felt I had to complain about in a decent bookshop. It was a Leonardo da Vinci Action Man. Presumably he was going to poke your eye out with a paintbrush. But even more importantly was the statement that was beside it. "Leonardo da Vinci was the original Renaissance man, inevitably. He was a master of painting, science, language, and the most important thing he contributed to civilization, he was the inspiration for Leonardo DiCaprio's name. You'll be pleased to know that an Einstein action man is to follow." They did have the good grace to remove it from the shop with some embarrassment. The point I want to lead on to from that, and we'll develop a little, is that it's very easy to see that as dumbing down. And perhaps there is an element of dumbing down in it. But I actually want to contend that it prefigures a quite different approach that students and young people today have of approaching the world, which essentially is one of illiteracy. Not illiteracy, but illiteracy. Where literacy is an optional extra. It's not a requirement. It's something you can use, put up and put down as you need, but it's not a necessary function to get through life. Indeed, in many universities, it's entirely possible to get a PhD in subjects like engineering without having any of those skills, to be illiterate. You form a hypothesis in the coffee room, you write some computer software, you run instrumentation, the instrumentation produces results which are analysed by a computer, you then draw conclusions from that. The literature search, which forms part of the PhD, is done on Google, or Google Scholar, and is essentially done through cut and paste. It's a quite different model from the classic way of gaining a PhD. So, the threat to libraries, as librarians have tended to perceive it, first, the absence of the Boolean gene. If only the world could do and or not, wouldn't it be a better place? But that's gone. Google has effectively killed that. Community centres. It's almost illegal to use the word library anymore. We don't have libraries anymore. We have things like community centres, things without books. There is a no doubt mythical, but it's a good story, about an anonymous library in the northwest of England, in a city of culture, but it had better remain anonymous. Think about it, come on. Which set up an internet cafe, which is an entirely appropriate thing to do, but then used the book fund to put a fitness room outside the internet cafe, on the basis that while you were waiting for your turn on the computer, you could at least get fit. Now, as I say, I'm sure that's an apocryphal story, but it's credible, isn't it? You can just imagine that happening in some local authorities. The growth of the bookshops, the cafe culture, we're all familiar with that, how pleasant and easy it is to go into Waterston and have a latte and a croissant and read something and maybe think about buying it, and if you fancy some music, you can have that at the same time. A quite new cultural experience in terms of books. Then this whole huge infrastructure, which I'll say more about. Sometimes it's known Amazon, Google, Abe Books, iTunes, eBay, PayPal, where it becomes possible with two or three clicks to get anything you want instantly with PayPal mechanisms which appear to cost nothing because they come in a statement at the end of the month. Instant gratification. Not something libraries are good at. And finally, something else I want to talk about then, the whole Web 2 thing of wikis, social information hubs, all of that kind of thing. In part because I think we sometimes miss the point about Web 2 and the whole social networking things which are behind it. I just like to put that one up because I like the way it spins in. I think that's brilliant. That, of course, is the elephant in the room. It's a gorilla. It really doesn't matter in many ways what libraries do about lots of these things because Google is just orders of magnitude bigger than anything else. The way in which Google determines searching is going to be done is the way searching is going to be done. And what we have to do is to accommodate to that, not to attempt to fight that. We have to learn to live with the gorilla, not fight it. So looking at Web 2, I've just created this little chart and you could do your own one. But essentially down the left-hand side is more or less a summary of traditional library activities. Cat and class, acquisitions, reference, and so on. And down the right is the things that replace them in the Web 2 world. And the contention of the Web 2 zealots would be that libraries have become redundant because every single traditional library activity has an alternative in a Web 2 world. There is nothing libraries do that can't be done at least as well, if not better, by those Web 2 activities. And in a sense, it doesn't matter whether you're completely au fait with folksonomies and the semantic web, with Flickr or what have you. The fact is that they are there, that people use them, and people are using them as alternatives. The fact that we don't know about them is perhaps rather telling sometimes. I would contend, however, that it is possible to respond to that with a Library 2 world in which we take control of all of these activities and put in library areas of activity which map onto these. And I've highlighted three for me which will come through the rest of this talk. The first one is trust metrics. What I used to call kite marking, but I gather the term now is trust metrics. It used to be the case that if a book was published by, say, Cambridge University Press, you had a pretty fair expectation of its standing, its stature, the qualities of the author, the qualities of the writing, and the quality of the argument, and the authoritative nature of the argument. So a book about the use of rifles in the United States by Cambridge University Press would say one thing. A book about rifles in the United States by the National Rifle Association would have a different set of trust metrics associated with it. You'd have a different perspective on what was going to be presented. That's all gone in the internet world. When you get a website that says cam.ac.uk, you have no idea whether it's Cambridge University Press or a student bedroom, because the trust metric has gone. Oddly enough, one of the metrics that people use, which we never really think about, is that libraries are, in a sense, a trust metric. The fact that something in a library is in a library, has gone through a selection process, is considered relevant to the purposes of the organisation, whether it's a university or a public library, is something that people value. Another trust metric. How many places are there left in the world where you would take a four-year-old child and leave them with a stranger for 2 or 3 hours? One that I'm aware of, the public library where there's a reading group. The other one is unique content, and I'll say more about this. When there are 36 million books available on Google, why do you need a library at all? And we need to think about that question because you can be sure our vice-chancellors will be thinking about that question and the heads of our city councils will be asking it. When it's all available on the net, why do you need a library? Well, for me, a lot of the answer lies in the unique content which libraries continue to collect and should continue to collect, but I don't think we do enough about that yet. When you look at what libraries actually acquire, certainly academic libraries, fully half of the things which are catalogued each year in the average university are not commercial. They do not come from the commercial world. There are archives, there's grey literature, there are pamphlets, all sorts of things which come in which don't fit within that commercial banner, which typically we pull together and call rare books and special collections. And I believe that it's in the area of those special collections, no matter how big or how small the library, there are special collections which are contributed to that global activity. And it's important that libraries are seen as a global activity, hence the importance of aggregation. One of the little known wonders, or little recognised wonders of the modern world to me, is the interlibrary loan system. There is no self-evident reason why the University of Worcester should be able to write to Moscow Public Library requesting a book. That book is sent. It may take 2 or 3 weeks, but it's sent. And even more astonishingly, it's sent back. Now, the reasons that's happened is, and Bob will know this, the reason that's happened is because librarians have got together, largely under the banner of the International Federation of Library Associations, and have created a global system which works very well, which brings together libraries from different countries, different disciplines, different activities into an international activity, which we simply take for granted. So that aggregation of content, I believe, is important. And the other key one for me there is teaching retrieval skills, and again, I'll come back to that. So why have librarians got into the mess that I believe we're in? Several reasons. First of all, I think we make the technology work too well. It's easy to go into libraries and get stuff on the internet and find it, or to find books in the library catalogue. We've made it seamless and easy. We tend not to brand it as something coming from the library. Nobody knows the work that goes into negotiating licenses to get commercial content, for example. It simply appears on people's screens and they think it's a free good. So we don't do enough to make it clear that actually this is rocket science. Secondly, and perhaps the major theme I have tonight, is the lack of any underpinning philosophy. We really don't know anymore why we need libraries. When everything's on the internet, what's the point? Quotation from a couple of academics, and I'm sorry it's a page full, but the important point here is that the emerging digital age library services are important, but there is no consensus on their significance to the future of the academic library, or even whether the library should be doing them, because almost all of the activities could be conducted by other people. But we have no coherent philosophy which says, why is it us? Why is it information professionals who are particularly appropriate for carrying on these functions? The future of the discussion of academic libraries has been limited to librarians and has not widened as it should have into the wider academic community. Something I hope we're beginning to address this evening. And then that very telling last sentence to me. Consequently, neither academic librarians nor others in the academy have a crisp notion of where exactly academic libraries fit in the emerging 21st century information panoply. That seems to be a very fair statement of where we are as a profession. Because of the fundamental role that academic libraries have played in the past century, difficult to imagine a college or university without a library, even if we don't know what it's for. But it's equally difficult to imagine what an academic library will be and do in another decade. And yet people are building libraries and wrestling with precisely that problem. This is not an agenda that librarians can or should accomplish alone. The other three reasons for failure, in my view, the rise of the managerial technocrat. When I started in libraries, all the old university libraries had statutes which went back decades, if not centuries. They all had and have three named officers in the university: the vice chancellor, the head of the administration, usually called the secretary or the registrar, and the university librarian. The only three statutory officers in the institution. When I was in my last post at King's College, I actually had a choir stall which said Bibliothecaris above it. We never went to chapel anymore, but I still had my stall, which distinguished me from the rest of the university as an important, not me, but the role of the librarian was an important figure in the organisation. Since then, libraries have become ever better run, the budgets have become bigger, the issues have become bigger, but I don't know any libraries that have gone bankrupt. Libraries are particularly well run within universities. Managerial technocrats have come in who run the places brilliantly and can handle things brilliantly, but I as librarian now have all the power and status of the head of estates. Now that's not insignificant. That's another fellow professional who's dealing with it, but that's a very real change from the point where I was one of the three named officers of the university. So although libraries are better run, I believe that in a paradoxical sort of way, the chief librarian has become a less influential figure within the organisation. And lastly, complacency. Well, you know, we started with tablets of stone and we saw them off, and then we saw off papyri and we saw off manuscripts. You know, we've seen it all before. Computers, they've only been here 40 years. We'll survive, we always do. We don't actually have to think about it. Somehow it will happen. And then finally, which to me is perhaps the biggest single failure of my generation of librarians, the failure to engage with e-resources. We're very good at negotiating licenses with publishers, but we've done very little else other than create what a colleague of mine called cabinets of curiosities. We've had great fun playing with digitization. We've digitized individual things. Cain is the Conflict Archive, which is the picture of murals in Northern Ireland. The Scottish Antarctic Expedition, which nobody's ever heard of because nobody died, so it wasn't terribly flattering. But one of my all-time favorite pictures of the Piper and the Penguin. Victorian Times, which is HMSO papers, which tell a little about Victorian life. And finally, and most interesting, The Valley of the Shadow, an American Civil War series. The importance of The Valley of the Shadow being that rather than just digitize cabinets of curiosities, as we've tended to do, they've actually added value, and that to me is the key. There are all sorts of links between oral records, newspaper records, personal testimonies, diaries, published literature, primary sources, secondary sources, hot links between them which add value to the collection, and which in fact create the collection, because the collection comes from something like 300 university libraries throughout the US. It's not a collection in a place. It's been created to represent the history of the Civil War. So we've not really worked out what electronic resources we want to have, why we're collecting them, or where we will put them. We have no idea what we're going to do with research data as it increasingly becomes digital. Whose responsibility is that? We have no idea in many institutions what the institutional repository is going to do. Is it purely peer-reviewed papers? Does it include learning objects? Does it include other outputs from the university? We have very little concept of what we're trying to build in the way of local collections. And at the same time, information is changing. These are slightly terrifying figures. I'm going to talk in a minute about how many, does anybody else know about Prensky's digital natives and digital immigrants? Yeah, good. Well, I'm going to talk a little about digital natives and digital immigrants. And essentially, these are the digital natives. 57% create content for the internet, 62% of content created by users is generated by someone they know, and 73% of students use the internet more than the library. That's slightly scary, because we're moving from a situation where there has been this notion of authoritative content to the wisdom of crowds, to consensus, to things being determined by block votes. That's not the sort of world that we've inhabited, because everybody in this room, I guess, is a digital immigrant. That's a very different kind of approach to how you create information. The threat to librarians. Well, two relatively recent examples from Bangor and SOAS over the last couple of years, where, in effect, the university administration needed to make cuts, decided to make cuts in the library. Rather than do the sensible thing of saying, we're short of money, we have to make cuts in the library, too bad, but that's life, what they said was, we don't need the library anymore because it's all on the internet, isn't it? And that's the wrong reason for making those sorts of cuts. And I'm delighted that particularly at SOAS, it was the academic staff, not the library staff, the academic staff who went on strike and said, no, actually, our professional colleagues in the library add value to the things we do. So there is a threat that administrators with less understanding than wit do begin to take the approach that if it's on the net, we can do without the library. Then there's what is, to be fair, something of a caricature, the British Library's approach at the other extreme, which says we don't need librarians. We need a head of marketing, we need a head of human resources, we need a head of sales in the shop, we need a lot of people with specialised skills to help us maximise the benefit from the collection. What we don't need are professional librarians to create and look after the collection. Of the senior management team in the British Library, there's 7 or 8 of them, I think one is a librarian. Interestingly, of course, the British Library is being notably successful at the moment, hitting the press with problems because too many people are using it, which is wonderful. The other thing is that we've tended to lack a distinctive professional voice. The one exception to that, which Bob will know more about than me, when we did actually manage to win was on the Patriot Act and the Terrorism Bill, where librarians were going to be banged in jail for lending textbooks on physics to students from Iran, just because that's what they did. But Anne was saying earlier that there's a lot more news about libraries in the press. But when did you last hear a librarian on Radio 4? When did you last hear that one of the judges of the Booker Prize was a librarian? When questions of information are raised on newspapers or television, do you hear a librarian being quoted? We don't have, I believe, a distinctive professional voice, and collectively there's an issue there. Partly because we're lumped in with culture and sport, so Rio Ferdinand tends to be our cultural professional voice at the moment. And then lastly, this quote, which should be anonymous, but comes from a colleague of mine, still practicing and still writing. Libraries are a source of power, this power deriving principally from the fact that libraries are the storehouses of knowledge and the repositories of the records of mankind's achievements and discoveries. That was true 50 years ago, but it's not true anymore. We are not uniquely the storehouses of knowledge and the repositories of the records of mankind's achievements and discoveries. We are now competitively in that position, not uniquely in it. And the threat to librarians to me from that is that kind of complacency in that statement, which says, as long as we build big book collections, we'll be all right. So, the response of librarians. One of my favourite bits of jargon recently, I've tried it on my Senate and it works a dream. When you stand there as a head of IT and say, yes, we are looking to the future, we are employing a digital overlap strategy to ensure business continuity. Now, you all know digital overlap strategy, don't you?
I'm just going to write it down.
Digital overlap. Keep your fingers crossed. That's a common response. I then want to talk about the other three new buildings, which a lot of places are going into. There's a lot of responses with new buildings, reshaped roles and new roles for librarians and libraries. But first, the digital overlap strategy, another cartoon which I rather like about how much of the planning for libraries seems to occur. In the middle there, then a miracle occurs. I think you should be more explicit here in step two. Well, I'm not sure that we very often are. We tend to go for the miracle occurring. Buildings. This is the public library in Seattle. It's a grand building. It's a wonderful, iconic building. It makes a firm architectural statement. It sits in Midtown right next to the soup kitchens, and they've doubled their user numbers because all the tramps come in and read the newspapers. And they're proud of that fact because they're providing a service to the citizens who are closest to them. And they make no bones about that. I laugh too, but they're very proud of that fact. And the sort of statements that are made about it. The library is a great space filled with interesting things to look at. Not to use, to look at. And useful spaces, but far too subtle for an obvious functional space like a public library. That's a very long-winded way of saying there are no signs to the toilets in that library, which causes a lot of problems. But when the city of Seattle did this, they were making a public statement about the cultural aspirations of the city. And they're quite specifically cultural aspirations of the city. And that, they see, is an iconic building in there. And it does it very well and very powerfully. Then possibly my personal favourite from Delft, the Book Bunker, which compares itself to an airport terminal. I like the sort of connotation of the Book Bunker, the last stand kind of stuff. It has long strips of study and office space that is organised around a central hall. And what it reminds me of more than anything else is an airport terminal, with lots of niche shops, pubs, clubs, cafes, internet terminals, lots of specific activities and small boutique-like activities. And I rather like that, and it works quite well. And it's also quite flexible because you can change and modify those spaces, quite small spaces. Then the classic, Aberdeen, which is about to spend $70 million on a new university library. And the architect speak here is wonderful. A glittering building with residences of the north, bullshit, connecting the library with the community itself. But the bit in the middle here, the monumental foundation of our historical collections. It's quite clear what they're about. They're about getting more of Bishop Elphinstone's papers and putting them in stacks for people never to look at. But that's the way they want to go. They see it as about building huge traditional paper-based collections. Then the one I rather like, just for the name, I'd said that libraries don't get called libraries anymore. The Ideas Store, which based in central London, Tower Hamlets is the example here, which has worked out how it's going to deal with its local community. Now, I may not like the answers, but they've clearly thought very carefully through how they're going to work with that local community and the services they need to offer. Adult education classes, career support, training, a creche, meeting areas, cafes, arts and leisure, and I gather they're talking about opening post offices because they're being shut down. Now, that's responding to the needs of the community as they perceive them to be, and I think that's really, really good. Not for me, but I think it's really, really good. Then one I hate, the Saltire Center at Caledonian University, 300 yards away from my office. The Saltire Center, this is quoted from them, the Saltire Center is a learning center. It links the teaching blocks on campus, providing easy access to 1,800 places to study, including a 600-seat learning cafe, 500 computers and 150 laptops to borrow and use anywhere. What doesn't it have? Books. No books. It's a wonderful student cafe. It's a wonderful internet cafe. It's a wonderful student union. What it does not, for me, perform is any of the functions you might associate with a library. But it wins lots of architectural prizes. But look, that's the statement they're making about their library. There is no mention of the word book. There is no mention of the word information. No mention of the word electronic resources. It's about somewhere to sit down and connect to the internet and get a cup of coffee. But my real worry is that what we've been doing is responding to changes in the media, the internet, what have you. But what of the real worry is that users have materially changed. This is the Prensky argument. That illiteracy is acceptable. The papers are full. I don't know whether it's an aging thing. The papers are full of these stories of students who can't read and write, who don't know where to put apostrophes, who misspell things, who use text speak the whole time, and generally are quite illiterate. I would argue they're not illiterate, they're illiterate. They don't need the things that we needed. I also think there's a case for saying that increasingly we're moving into an image-based rather than a text-based society. Several examples of that. What would you do, what would a normal person do if a 200-foot wall of water starts running towards them at something like 60 miles an hour? Well, any sensible person would run for the hills. But when it's a tsunami, what people now do is get out their video camera to shoot pictures of themselves being killed. The London Tube bombings. One of the first things that most of the passengers did was to get their cell phones out, not to phone home, but to take pictures. Now, sometimes this is conflated with the so-called citizen journalism. I think it's a quite different phenomenon in the way in which we're moving to an image-based society. And I want to examine this with you with a little test. If I make a number of statements like, Dr. Livingston, I presume, we shall fight them on the beaches. Never in the field of human conflict. Ask not what your country can do for you. I have a dream. You know exactly what I'm talking about. We share those cultural reference points. Not difficult. I would contend that in the last 30 or 40 years, we've moved to image-based reference points. And what we now start doing is not describing events, but describing the pictures that describe events. I'm going to give you a little test. First of all, proving that I'm a digital immigrant. I'm about to show you 20 pictures. Two of them are Scottish. And because I'm a digital immigrant, I'm not willing to spend the time learning how to change them to two pictures which are more relevant to Worcester. So you're allowed to get 18 out of 20 and still pass. I would be astonished if most of you don't get 16 or 17 of these images as the new cultural reference points. In the second row in the middle is, of course, of the captain of the first British team to win the European Cup. But leaving that aside for the moment, what we begin to do now is not to talk about the Vietnam War. The iconic thing that we talk about there is the picture of the little girl running down the road. We don't even describe the event. We start to describe the picture. And all of these are the images which don't have text associated with them anymore. They're not like E equals MC squared, but you know exactly what they are. And to me, that's all part of the way in which Flickr and YouTube, all of those visual stores are beginning to develop in quite powerful ways, because that's the way that an illiterate generation begins to respond. And the argument is that this is not an incremental change. Whether or not one agrees with Prensky, I really like this metaphor of the digital native and the digital immigrant, and the suggestion that we have reached a point of discontinuity. Today's students, first generations growing up with these new technologies, and just the numbers which are being quoted there, quite phenomenal. Less than 5,000 hours reading, but over 10,000 hours playing video games and 20,000 hours watching TV. You know, as you walk around, people walking around with cell phones in their hands, all of this kind of stuff. That's the integral part of the lives of digital natives, and no matter how hard we immigrants try, we inhabit a different world. Bellarmine College in the United States produces a yearbook every year with the characteristics of the incoming students. And this is a conflation of the last 2 years of the 18-year-old students going into Bellarmine College. They've grown up with bottled water. You know that's true. In fact, I suspect they're now born with a bottle of water in their hand. Thanks to MySpace and Facebook, autobiography happens in real time. That probably doesn't mean a great deal to most people in the audience, except you know it happens. That's how people... A nice interesting test is to ask people how many friends they have. A typical man will say, close friends. And a typical man will say 3 or 4. A typical woman will say 8, 9, 10. Ask a 17-year-old, male or female, and they'll say, oh, 200 or 300. Many of them people they've never met. Quite different approach to how they run their life because of MySpace and Facebook. JFK and Malcolm X, who for us are real people, for them are part of Hollywood. Information's ephemeral and consensual, not authoritative, as I've been saying. Fax has come and gone before they even learned how to use it. To Google has always been a verb. Virtual reality has always been available. Control-Alt-Delete is more common than ABC. And they've never been able to find the return key. It doesn't, of course, exist, the return key. The function does, but not the key. Computers have always fitted in their backpacks. Stores have always had scanners. They've always had a PIN number. They don't remember when cut and paste involved scissors, and Bill Gates has always been worth $1 billion. That's a different planet from the one in which I grew up. And again, the point being that this is a discontinuity, not an incremental change. So, digital natives have different expectations. They expect research to be easy and feel they can be independent in the process. They don't seek help, generally from either librarians, and only occasionally from professors or peers, and even with them, it's rarely face-to-face. It's usually text or internet or mail. And when they can't find what they need, they give up. If it's not on the internet, it doesn't exist. Students stop because they think they've exhausted the process. Because what they want to do is get just enough for the task in hand, not to find the right answer. I have an assignment to get in at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. I need just enough to get through that process. And then other interesting ones where I think we fail them. Access to full text articles does seem to have changed things because there's much more and more of cut and paste. You find the relevant bit, you cut it and paste, and then we complain about plagiarism. I suspect the real failure is our failure to teach them about proper citation. Because we haven't understood quite how all-embracing cut and paste has become. And the more electronic resources we make available, the more cut and paste will become the norm. This is a slide which Lorcan Dempsey from OCLC produced after a study of how students put together their work. And it looks at all the resources which students use. And the list here doesn't particularly matter. They're all net-based resources. The key point in this slide is that the word library doesn't appear anywhere. A typical student is going to use all of those things to put together their assignments, wikis, social hubs, Technorati, YouTube, Flickr, all of those sorts of things, but they won't feel the need to go to the library. That's a terrifying one for me. But this, in some ways, I find the most worrying of all. Prensky's contention, not just about digital natives and digital immigrants, which has been questioned quite fairly, but about digital content, that the very nature of content itself is subject to that discontinuity. And the phrase I find chilling is the notion of legacy content. Legacy content includes reading, writing, arithmetic, logical thinking, and understanding the writings and ideas of the past. Civilization has gone. Includes reading, writing, arithmetic, logical thinking. Some of it will continue to be important, but some, and one can see how this has happened, some, like Euclidean geometry, will become less so, as did Latin and Greek. I don't suppose hardly anybody learns Latin, Greek, and geometry these days, and the world is not a worse place for it, so there is no self-evident reason why other major functions need to continue. And then he goes on about future content, software, hardware, robotics, nanotechnology, and the ethics, politics, and sociology which surround them. But that concept that there might just be legacy content and future content is one that I find very disturbing. So, you'll be sorry to hear this is not the conclusion of the lecture, just the conclusions of this section. conclusions. The Net Generation has a different value. There are many names, of course, for the Net Generation, but that group of digital natives has a different value structure. They want choice, but they want selectivity. They want personalization. Most importantly, they want instant gratification because convenience trumps quality. Every time, convenience trumps quality. Cheap, fast, and good, mobile anytime, anywhere technology, mobile anytime, anywhere information, martini education, anytime, anyplace, anywhere. And just enough. I spent much of my professional career arguing about just-in-time and just-in-case kinds of libraries, only to discover that we'd got it completely wrong. It's just enough that people want. And technology is a norm, not chalk and talk. I went to a terrifying lecture in South Africa last year where a lecturer created a lecture on the fly while she was talking. It was a lecture she was to give the next day. The library was closed. She couldn't get any of the resources she needed for the lecture. She couldn't get any of the readings. So she got them all from the net. She'd worked out how to crack Amazon so that you can print out whole chapters of books. I'll tell you for a small fee over the canopies how you can do that. How you can download things, how you can buy stuff, buy pages of information using PayPal. How you can do that at 1 o'clock in the morning when it's convenient to you, not when it's convenient to the library. So that, when I want it, just enough to get me through the process, applies as much to academic teaching staff as it does to the students. Another worry, information is becoming more and more ephemeral. I'm never sure how these statistics are produced, but leaving that aside, 44% of websites disappear within a year. Now, this is not the sort of not just personal individual stuff going. British Library websites disappear. The National Library of France website, or bits of websites, disappear. Big organizations are no better at managing that kind of information than anybody else. Wikipedia becomes the norm. Now, you'll all have heard all the arguments about the accuracy of Wikipedia and bullying on Wikipedia and people changing their own entries. But the fact remains that the Encyclopedia Britannica has 2 million entries, Wikipedia has 20 million entries. There's a 90% chance that Wikipedia is going to be right. There's also a chance that Britannica is going to be wrong, but we never talk about what's wrong in Britannica. We only compare it with the imperfect world of Wikipedia. And with a little bit of care, it's actually very easy to work out what's contentious in Wikipedia and what's good, solid stuff. Things like Wikipedia are here to stay, and it's what students will use. User not expert created. There is this kind of myth of unless you're an academic, you can't be right. But we all know brilliant, gifted amateurs. We all know people who know lots about subjects who may not be academics in the formal sense. But it doesn't mean they can't create perfectly respectable Wikipedia entries. And again, interestingly, information becomes democratic, not authoritative. So, the conclusion to draw from that is that the role of the library and the librarian becomes much more one of managing the information, managing the trust metrics, managing the access, not managing the storage, which is what librarians historically have done, manage the storage of information. But, and this is the thing I think most organizations have not yet got to grips with, I believe that one of the roles for libraries, which other people could take, but which libraries can lay claim to fairly, is the need to digitize, curate, and make available all corporately owned or created content. Whether that's raw data, whether it's peer-reviewed articles, whether it's reusable learning objects, and so on. That managing of the intellectual output of the organization. And lastly, I think information literacy is a critical skill. Lots of debate about that. We have the European Computer Driving License, which is very popular with students. I believe some similar kind of thing on the information side has value, and we've not yet got that right. A lot of work going into that area, but we've not yet got that right. So just to remind you of how big the gorilla in the room is. Facebook. These figures are almost a year old, and so they're already out of date. 95% of students in North America have Facebook pages. 80% of all students in the US have Facebook pages. It's a sustainable social network for life, not just for learning. Looking at MySpace, 250,000 new users a day. 50 million users a day, 30 billion page views a month. It doesn't really matter what we fiddle about within our libraries unless we have some philosophy of what we're trying to do and unless we find ways of working with the big beasts, we're simply just not in the same ballpark at all. So, the sorts of things that we should be doing in libraries, I believe. Reshaping existing roles. First of all, financial guardian. I think I said earlier that I've never heard of libraries going bankrupt. We're very good at balancing the books. Ho, ho, ha, ha. We're very good at doing that kind of thing. Just as a small example, licensing becomes important. Last year, my maths department came to me and said, could you buy us a copy of American Mathematical Society publications? It's only $10,000. I politely told them to go and take a running jump. It was the middle of the financial year. All the budget had gone. No chance. They said, no, it's all right. We've got $10,000, actually. We just thought we'd try. That was fine. 3 weeks later, one of my subject librarians discovered that for $100, we could get a site license, provided the maths department had paid the whole lot. Nobody in the maths department cared what happened in physics or chemistry, so they hadn't bothered to pay the extra $100. But the role of the information broker in the middle, the financial guardian of the institution, became quite an important one. Selecting, acquiring relevant information, making sure that it's available, that it's kite-marked, providing seamless access, educating on differentiation, which version of Index Medicus do you want, why is this product better than that product, the actual management of data sets for the organization, and managing the intellectual assets. That management of intellectual assets is really a new role, managing the primary resources of the institution. And I think at all levels, in all organizations, managing the outputs of the organization is a key developing role that we should have, including research data collection. Most researchers aren't interested in the data beyond the life of the research grant. They want to put it away after that and forget about it. That's really not good enough as a solution. We need to find ways of handling that. Information arbitrage, a term I've tried to coin to look at how you acquire resources from different time zones in different countries at different periods to get the best financial deal for the university. And lastly, training, law's second law. I've reached that stage in my life when I want things named after me. It is not good enough that half the universities in the world have named a library after me. Thank you. The law library, yes, yes. So training, law's second law. Law's second law is that user-friendly systems aren't. As soon as the shrink wrap package says there is no manual, it's all available on the net through FAQs, you know that you need to run training sessions. So training, one of the key areas that we have to look at, and trust metrics, something which libraries implicitly have at the moment that we don't take enough advantage of, and I think a key role there. And then looking at the complete span, I love this picture apart from anything else. I think it's gorgeous. But just the range of things that libraries are involved in, from almost from the cradle to the grave, that whole lifelong learning activity. I have this notion that historically that has been the great strength of libraries in all sectors, public, university, school, what have you. The support of individual learning, the support of individuals in the learning process. Sure, all the leisure activity is great, but it's that support for learning which from Victorian times straight through, to me, has been the bedrock of what libraries should be about and should still be about. I wanted to say just a little about research, and I like this New Yorker cartoon. I had my own blog for a while, but I decided to go back to just pointless, incessant barking, which is kind of what I'm doing just now. There's a lot of debate about the future of the academic journal, about green route, gold route, all of that kind of institutional repository, open access sort of stuff. The worry for me is that while people like me are focusing on that agenda, we're not noticing that the whole Web 2 activity, the whole social networking activity, is changing the fundamental nature of scholarly communication. And that that kind of social networking is beginning to emerge in a number of disciplines. Now, I go to my Senate, and I mention the names that are going to come up in a minute, and people look at me with blank amazement. But the people who are doing this are in Harvard and Yale and MIT and Imperial and UCL, and it's not numpty stuff. This is serious change going on. So just these names, I don't know how many of them, or any of them, people know. Blue Obelisk, Open Wetware, NanoHub, Sermo, Innocentive, Nature Preceding, a nice little pun there. All of them are scientific researchers forming net-based communities to share their research results. Now, there is still peer publication, of course, because that's how we get through the RAE, but not every country has an RAE and feels the same need. In the States, once you're tenured faculty, there is not the same pressure to publish in the same way. You can be a little more exploratory in the ways you deal with scholarly communication. Folksonomies. Again, I won't say, as time's going, I won't say a lot about that, but one of the ways of bringing those communities together where you can see, simply by the size of the typeface, what other people are working on, what references they have, what citations they have, what sites they're linked to. Some libraries have responded. WorldCat, good example here, which tells you where the nearest copy of a book is. This one was based in Edinburgh. You can find two copies in under a mile, or you can go 41 miles to Glasgow Caledonian University, where, interestingly, you will find it's been sent back to Edinburgh to be put in the National Store, so you had a wasted journey. But that's another story. Some libraries, again, responding. This is Ohio, where they've created a site for their earth science students, pooling together all of the electronic resources which the university purchases, acquires, and makes available, and creating a fixed resource there which adds value to the purchase by demonstrating to students what they should be looking at. Biological engineering. This is the researchers themselves, Open Wetware. An effort to promote the sharing of information amongst researchers. And it's done through webs, not through publication. It's done through wikis, through blogs. Eastern University. How can libraries respond? Eastern University has created a virtual reference library on Second Life. Guy in the kilt is me, by the way. That's me in Second Life. Visiting Cyberry City in the University of Michigan Library. And what I love about this one is that you can do all your reference work online, and you can talk to the library specialists, or at least you can talk to their avatars. How many librarians look like those avatars? That's what librarians would like to look like, rather than what we do look like. It's the guy in the grey on the bottom left with all the muscles that I think is weird. Interestingly, one of our leading school librarianship lecturers famously has an avatar on Second Life and does some teaching on there. But interesting exploring Second Life, because when reality is too complicated, a virtual Second Life is actually quite attractive to a lot of people. And of course, it's a real library. You can begin to get e-books on Second Life. Curiously, in this traditional wood-paneled library setting, but nonetheless, these are e-books, and there will be 36 million of them within 6 years. This is not a small private library in a room, 36 million of them. The Google Library Project is going to digitize most of these. That's another scary one. Google is looking at online book rentals, the return of the books library. And when I can pay 99 cents to get it at 2 o'clock in the morning when I need it, rather than wait for the next day to go into the library, what am I going to do? The Open Content Alliance, which is looking at non-commercial material, making it available. So, what if you can find those 35 million books through the Google collection? Does the library have a strategy to deal with that? I suspect that most of us don't. And what if there are these easy payments, which allow you to buy things just like you buy on iTunes or just like you buy on eBooks? It's as easy as that. Bought. Your entire college life could be powered by Google or by Microsoft. Mail, talking, SMS, maps, Scholar, pictures through Picasa. All of those things are available on your desktop or in your bedroom. And the entire entertainment world then mutating, streaming everything everywhere. Nothing that we have is original, nothing we have is separate, nothing we have is distinctive, as things stand. It's providing that distinctiveness that is the key for us. I just like this burning inhale one. So, the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. These are the things which are really the threats to us, all of these things which we have to respond to. We have to respond to what I believe is that fundamental discontinuity. Now, we have the tools, we have the traditional skills, we have the opportunities, but we need to put a coherent philosophy together of what we're trying to do. So, the final option is getting to the close. One of the biggest ones for me, which a trick which I think we're fundamentally missing, is building e-research connections and adding value to them. Again, I'm not sure if any of you know the Emory collection on slaving, Emory University collection on slaving, the slave voyages across the Atlantic. They've taken the resources of libraries on both sides of the Atlantic, they've digitized them and made them available, but then they've provided all the scholarly links which allow you to link individuals to voyages, voyages to parts of the United States or the Caribbean, looked at datelines. All of the information is presented in useful form to you. You don't actually have to do a lot with it. So building collections and adding value to them within a research environment. This is as much a scholarly activity as it is a teaching activity. the importance of kite marking, quality assurance trust metrics. I won't go on about that further. I believe there's a great task there that we have to undertake, managing institutional resources, and then co-created services. Interlibrary loan is the classic model, as I said, but there are other things we can be doing in that electronic environment, creating value-added services and training. Now, these have, I think, fairly obvious implications for me for the design and build of libraries of the future. Training spaces, access to these e-resources. Of course, we'll still be running hybrid libraries with books for a long time to come, but it implies a lot more flexible space in which one can be doing things like training, in which students can be working collectively and collaboratively together rather than in individual private study spaces. It assumes access to food and drink. It implies fairly unlimited access in terms of time. But it also implies that access to research support. There's an easy assumption which Bangor and SOAS made that as we move to a more electronic environment, you can shed library staff, no counter staff, no binding, no shelving, and you can make savings in the library budget. That's true, but the staff you will be more highly skilled. So you'll be paying more for higher quality staff who are able to do all of those tasks, training, teaching, building research connections, building links, adding links, kite marking, relevant resources, all of those sorts of things. So I actually see a great opportunity for the profession in upskilling as part of this. Now that's the way we tend to respond. Pretending that it's not a fundamental discontinuity. It's just library two, a few more books and stuff, a bit more people, some radical trust, a bit of participation, a picture of Einstein as a genuflection to the fact that we're now in an image-based society, and that'll do it for you, at least according to Darlene Fichter, who I'm sure I know and love dearly, but that seems to be to miss the point entirely. Actually, the world is much more like this. Thank you. Oh. I missed my final gag. I'm sorry. Just one line. I don't know how many of you noticed on the way in the sign that says adult nursing. Did anybody notice that on the way in? And underneath it, it says no, K-N-O-W, dot, can do. That should be the library slogan. No, can do. Thank you. Now I'm finished. Sorry.
That was challenging. What do I feel like? You remember Scotty in the first Star Trek? I think it was him. This is civilization, Captain, but not as we know it. And that's kind of what I feel you've done, exposed a world to make us think about where we are differently. We've got about 15 minutes where we can take questions. I'm going to ask Judith to tell me when 10 minutes are up because I'm not wearing my watch. So has anybody got any questions or areas of discussion or comment? And I think Bob has...
Why? Has he been primed, Mr. McKee?
It's a very difficult one because you presented such a lot of stuff, Derek. In all of that, why spend 47 million quid building a new library?
That's a very good question which deserves an answer from the university. seriously, there are yes, I know I do. I think the importance of library as space, which I didn't touch on a great deal, but the importance of library as space remains fundamental. The point I made about leading four-year-old kids is of course a kind of extreme example, but library as social space is a really, really critical part of any organisation. Most universities have lost much of their social space, if only in the sense that increased student numbers, putting more pressure on social spaces, has an impact. So library social space is important. Increasingly, the kind of learning experience which students get is different. It's no longer, or it's much more rarely now, a solitary experience where you go to the library to be on your own. You go to work, not just with other people, but with other resources. And those resources will tend to reside in the library. You want one place on the campus that you can keep open 24 hours. You don't want everywhere open 24 hours. So physically, it's helpful to have that kind of concentrated space. But I think for as long as we can see into the future, there will be resources which are, for one reason or another, housed in the library. They may not be networked, for example, but available in the library. So the reasons for people to come together in one space to work with each other, but with the resources, I think will remain an important one. But we have to get that right, because I think, for me, the getting it wrong is building the sort of Saltire-centric Glasgow Caledonian, which is a student union. And it's a wonderful student union, but it's not a library where people go to learn, study, and research. I'm sorry, I obviously didn't make that clear. I don't view Google as an enemy. I think it's so big, we have to work with it. Whatever one might think of it, we have to work with it.
And another thing about Google, I think, with the library project, I was interested in what you were talking about there. I think the people who work in Google are quite special people. They're obviously highly elite people. And some of their skills I'd like to see used in the library environment with the philosophy. We've responded, haven't we, the library, with our catalogue searching is a lot better now than it was 10 years ago. We're only doing that because we're driven by the competition.
But there are still universities where they're arguing about disposing of the card catalogue. You know, one tends to forget the people in this room are almost certainly the progressives. The 25,000 or whatever it is members that Bob has a complete range of people who really are not interested in the antiquarian side, right through to people who are outright opponents. Google is great because it wants to be a library. It quite overtly says that that's the game it's in. But I still get the sense, we had a presentation to our university court 2 weeks ago, and my head of reference services was showing people the Google search screen and the one he'd built 3 years ago, which ran to 5 pages and was crammed full of stuff. And this Google thing, it's so simple, isn't it? Look at my one, it's much fuller and more comprehensive, much nicer, but you can have this Google one if you really want. And there's a tendency to underestimate the power of Google and the fact that people use it. What we have to do, you're quite right, is to build on what Google gives us, not to fight it. But there is still, I think, professionally a hardcore, and quite a large hardcore, who would like to try and compete with Google. It's not worth it. Not worth it.
I think the thing that scares me most is something you haven't really mentioned. I mean, an awful lot of your examples, the Civil War, the American Civil War one, and various things like that, the Google Digitization Project. All that's happening at the moment is people are taking the traditional resources. Lots of them copyright free, but for various other reasons, doing very clever things with them. But all the kind of social networking and sort of things you're talking about, to me, are actually moving towards destroying the social structures that created all that material that we're busily digitizing. So if you fast forward 50, 60 years, what are we digitizing? What are we getting at? What are we creating these collections from?
There's a very trivial example of that which concerned me when I was at King's College, where we had Sir James Black, Nobel Prize winner in medicine. And historically, what librarians used to do with people like Sir James Black was they waited till he died, then two of them went down to his house, one to console the grieving widow, and one to go into the study and clear it of all the overdue library books, but also all the papers. Nowadays, they might go in and collect a hard drive, but of course, there's more and more of that collected in other places. Now, he's a Nobel Prize winner. What is the official policy in collecting the email of potential Nobel Prize winners in this institution? I imagine it's the same as in my institution. We haven't got a clue. And it's precisely that sort of information which we need to begin to develop some philosophy about. I think we're nowhere in that game. I think I'm ahead of the game, as you clearly are, in just highlighting that there's a problem. I don't think we've got the faintest understanding of how to begin to do it. The same with research data. We used to have lab books. Not anymore. Now there's this collection of data which computing people with an excess of generosity will agree to keep for 3 years. Well, I'm interested in 300, not three. Sun have just produced some kit where they will guarantee the life and the accuracy of data for 50 years. 50 years. It's nothing. So there's a huge issue there. I couldn't agree with, but I have no answers of any sort. The first thing, though, to do is to highlight the problem and get people to begin to address it. It's just not happening.
Your vision for the future, I find extremely challenging. Let's reflect on what you think are the implications of that, the relationship between librarians and academics and
I think we need each other more than ever. I would like to revert to the situation where the librarian, and by extension the library staff, were not seen as managerial technocrats, but part of the collective academic process. I always have this, I've fallen out with people over this before, I always have this image in academic life of a three-legged stool, in which one element is the academic staff, one element is the administration, and one is the library and IT staff, and the seat is the common platform, which is the delivery of education. And each leg is necessary. If you take one leg away, the stool falls over. It's a rather trite example, but it seems to me that we are all partners in this, and all too many institutions see it as a hierarchical activity, in which the library and the administration are a drain on the resources which are won by the academics. It shouldn't be like that. It's a partnership activity. One of the things I'd hope to demonstrate this evening is that there's a lot of thinking, a lot of activity going on the library side about those futures, about the ways in which learning happens, and a lot of help that can be given, a lot of support that can be given to academic staff to free them up so that they can be doing the thing they should be doing, which is the teaching. There's a lot of mechanistic stuff which librarians can be doing to take away some of the drudgery. And if one accepts the premise, and I accept that it's a big if, but if one accepts the premise that there is a fundamental discontinuity and not just an incremental change, it's even more important that one understands how people are behaving.
I think we've got time for two more. Rachel Johnson, University of Worcester. I went to a research student's training day at the British Library in the autumn, and I was very surprised that we have seven people who are signing up, both staff from the British Library and academics, emphasising the importance of print collections because of what they brought to research that digital resources didn't bring. It seemed to me at the time that instead of those two views working together, there seems to be a lack of seeing them as a balance. Could you comment on that, please?
I think that's fair. There is a tendency to see it as a competitive activity when it should be complementary. And the concept of the hybrid library was intended to try and bring some of that together, but it really never quite took off, in my estimation. The balance is really interesting, because the balance is going to be very different in central London, where you have Imperial College, LSE, SOAS, the British Library, within a mile of where you are. And it's going to be different in Worcester, and it's going to be different in Glasgow, where in order to get access to 36 million books, my only choice is the internet. So the trick, I think, for library staff is to work out, and that's one of the challenges we face, is to work out what that appropriate balance is. But recognising that whether we like it or not, more and more stuff is simply born digital. It's a fact of life. The books aren't going to go away, so we have to manage them effectively, but things are born digital increasingly. And I'm not sure we really accommodate that fact. We assume that it's somebody else's problem, that they're born somewhere else on the internet, and we can be sort of loving aunts and uncles and just pat them on the head occasionally when we need them. Actually, we have, like interlibrary loan, to aggregate all of this stuff and work out larger collective solutions, not individual institutional ones, and look at that balance.